when I was invited to one show, everybody met in the woods first, and it was getting dark. It was getting dark, so you couldn't really see faces that clearly, and I had a kid flash a light in my face and ask me who I was with, and so I had to say, like...
That's Alex Herbert, a graduate student in Russian studies at Indiana University, describing a punk rock show he attended in Nizhny Novgorod, Russia.
It was in what looked like somebody's apartment, but it was an apartment that was totally empty, and there was just graffiti all over the walls, and all of the lights there, they were all tied to this extension cord, and as was all the band's equipment, which was in, like, one room. And so if you can imagine being in an apartment, and there's just one room where the band is, and everybody else is kind of just sprawled throughout, that's how it was.
Herbert, along with local journalist Tommy Dean, are currently working on a book chronicling the history, trends, and figures of Russian punk rock music. It's a challenging task, gathering information on a myriad of artists, genres, fanzines, fashions, and local scenes, all linked together, as Herbert puts it, by sound and attitude. What also makes the history difficult is that the genre didn't even begin in Russia, but rather in America and England.
And these were bands doing kind of just sloppy rock and roll, where attitude and energy took precedence over technical ability.
Andy Hollanden, a senior lecturer at the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music, teaches courses on the history of rock and roll.
It was just really fun, and it was rocking, and people would have a good time. And what also I think comes with punk is having something to say.
American and British punk, he says, grew out of reaction to pop, where the musicians had a different attitude and message.
So it was getting away from the poppy boy-girl type of subject matter of bands like the Beatles and whatnot, and just getting rawer, sloppier, funner. That said, I don't mean to make it sound like it's easy. That is the mistake I think a lot of people make, is though people play punk music because they can't play, in quotation marks, real music, which nothing could be further from the truth.
The book plans to chronicle the transmission of punk into the Soviet Union in the late 1970s. During this point of the Cold War, the exchange of ideas between the two cultures was scarce, so punk made its way into the country only through clandestine means, limited to what people could get through customs.
By, say, 1980, there are British or American or German or Dutch or Danish students who are going to the Soviet Union, and they bring music with them because they do, and that starts to spread in that way. So you lend somebody your cassette that you've brought.
Patrick Kenny, professor of history and international studies and the director of the Russian and East European Institute at Indiana University, experienced this underground cultural exchange firsthand.
You know, when I went in, I had some mixtapes, and they didn't go through and, you know, try to figure out what was on each cassette. But if I had records, yes, they would have looked through the records. Yes, they would have pulled out the records to see what was actually in there besides the record, and they might have taken some, and sometimes they did. I'm not aware that they had any sort of rule of, you know, any blacklist, for example, and you could never be sure. It was sort of a random system.
At first, Russian punk rock tried to emulate the sounds from those early Western bands like the Sex Pistols or Minor Threat. But because the music that made it through could vary so widely, the Russian punk scene was able to define itself.
It becomes something that is genuinely local. Because of punk's DIY aesthetic, that meant it was intensely local. Right, it is about you take it and you create it yourself. And hey, by the way, you can.
Punk is often politically charged music, and the authors explain that the politics of punk in the Soviet Union were much different as compared to the West. Here's Hollanden again.
Well, in England, you know, as they were, you know, being faced with Margaret Thatcher and the concept of no future. And in the Sex Pistols, in the song God Save the Queen, actually, it was originally called No Future. And the end of the song is no future, no future for you, and there's no future for me.
No future, no future for you.
A lot of the dispossessed kids in England at the time felt that their backs were against the wall and they had nothing to lose, and so they took a fighting stance.
But as Herbert hopes to make clear in his book, the consequences of this fighting stance were much more dire in the Soviet Union.
God Save the Queen, you know, it's not really going to incite any searches from the British secret police. Whereas in Russia, in the Soviet Union, Yegor Letov, who's singing, you know, I'll Always Be Against, is being pursued from show to show by KGB members who are standing in his crowd watching him.
Punk punk rock grew into its own in Russia, and highlighting that independent growth is one of the primary goals of Herbert and Dean's book.
Yeah, I mean, part of, I think, the purpose of the project is to let Russian punk rock speak for itself. It's very easy to take a subculture like punk rock that was created in the West and superimpose that or like transplant that into a non-Western society, because Russia is very much non-Western. And so to constantly parallel Western, you know, punk rock to Russian punk rock is just, it's not being completely fair and not letting Russian punk rock speak for itself.
I think that any way we can get to know better the culture of Soviet and Russian punk and see it not just as a thing borrowed from the West, I think that's really essential, because it was something that people experienced as their own. And so that means that we should approach punk as something that is local and locally experienced and is produced from within.
Herbert and Dean's process of researching, promoting, and publishing the book is also taking a page out of the punk rock playbook. They're being funded by a Kickstarter campaign, Building from the Ground Up, which aligns closely with punk's DIY or do-it-yourself ethic. Here's Tommy Dean.
I mean, that's kind of how punk started. It was, you know, a bunch of kids recording their own music, starting their own record labels, distributing their own records, setting up their own tours, basically doing everything from what we call now a grassroots level. And so for us, you know, we're trying to raise the money ourselves through a Kickstarter, which is, I guess, a modern means of DIY, because we're also letting people who want to see this project come to fruition contribute.
With research and production help from Taylor Killow, I'm Mark Chilla for WFIU Arts.